Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today, December 29th, is the last Sunday in 2024. We will revisit major science stories from early in the year. In this New York Times trilobite, dated January 11th, we find that a new origin story for Tyrannosaurus rex suggested by Fossil. Researchers say the species they named Tyrannosaurus magraeensis predated the dinosaur era's great predator. A team of researchers have announced the discovery of a new species of Tyrannosaurus from New Mexico, one that appeared in the fossil record 5 million to 7 million years before the familiar tyrant lizard. Their research, published in the journal Scientific Reports, suggests a new chapter could be added to the origin story of Tyrannosaurus rex. When staff from the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science collected the partial skull of a large adult Tyrannosaurus from the Elephant Butte Reservoir in the state of New Mexico in the 1980s, they initially assumed the fossils belonged to T. rex. But when Sebastian Dahlman, a paleontologist at the museum, began working on the specimen in 2013, he noticed subtle but consistent differences between it and other T. rex skulls. Rather than the deep bone-crushing jaws of an adult T. rex, the lower jaw of the reservoir specimen looked more slender. Its teeth were different, and the animal lacked the prominent ridge of bone found behind T. rex's eye, Mr. Dahlman said. Scientists estimate that the animal was approximately 39 feet long, around the same length as an adult T. rex. T. rex fossils are believed to be 66 to 68 million years old, the period recorded in the Hell Creek Formation of the Plains States, said Spencer Lucas, paleontology curator at the museum and an author on the paper. When the fossil was initially discovered, researchers initially assumed the rock layers that produced it, the McRae Formation of New Mexico, belonged to the same period. But the team's dating of the rocks now suggests that the McRae Formation was 5 to 7 million years older than Hell Creek, and that the specimen they found came from an earlier relative. Most species are not around for more than a million years, Dr. Lucas said. The age argument really is matched by the anatomy. The researchers argue that this is enough evidence to conclude that the skull belongs to a distinct species, which they've named Tyrannosaurus magraeensis, after the formation where the specimen was found. Over the past few years, some scientists have argued that certain fossils assigned to T. rex actually represented new species and have faced serious pushback from other scholars. Researchers in the field have generally been reluctant to split apart such an iconic and well-studied species without overwhelming evidence. This is going to get a lot more scrutiny than the average newly named dinosaur, said Dave Hone, a paleontologist at Queen Mary University of London, who was not involved with the paper. But he and other outside researchers have reacted more warmly to T. magraeensis than to other purported Tyrannosaur discoveries, noting that the authors have made a reasonable and compelling case. That the remains seem both outside the usual range of variation for T. rex and comfortably separated in time strengthens the argument, said Thomas R. Holtz, Jr., a paleontologist at the University of Maryland. The find also has interesting implications for the timeline of Tyrannosaurus's evolution, Dr. Holtz said. Throughout the late Cretaceous period, Tyrannosaurus relatives ranged across what is today Western North America, from Alaska to Mexico. By the last million years of the dinosaur's reign, however, the larger T. rex replaced these lineages. Since the closest known relatives of Tyrannosaurus are from Mongolia, Dr. Holt said, some researchers argued that Tyrannosaurus represented a specific group that crossed a land bridge from Asia. But the new discovery suggests that the Tyrannosaurus lineage appeared in North America 5 to 7 million years earlier than expected, and may have originated in the Southwest before spreading north. There's obviously more going on than just a move north, given that we have the Asian lineages too, Dr. Hone said. Big Tyrannosauruses were getting around. If Tyrannosaurus did appear in the Southwest, the team suggests, the genus's giant size may have evolved to prey on the enormous herbivores found in the region, like Alamosaurus, a sauropod that grew up to 100 feet long, and Sierraceratops, an earlier relative of Triceratops. But what caused such a landscape of comparative giants to appear in a specific region of North America remains a mystery. I think we need to spend more time looking at the Southwest, said Nick Longridge, a paleontologist at the University of Bath in England and an author on the paper. There are a lot of poorly studied areas where we're going to find new things. And this New York Times trilobite was posted by Asher Elbine. The big news is the landing of an American spacecraft on the surface of the moon. From the Washington Post, Intuitive Machines makes first U.S. moon landing in 51 years. While it reached the surface and was communicating with the ground, the exact condition of the lander was unknown. Published on February 22nd at 5:17 p.m. and updated about 3 hours after that. For the first time since the last of the Apollo missions in 1972, an American spacecraft reached the surface of the moon, a significant step toward NASA's plan to eventually return astronauts to Earth's closest celestial neighbor. After a tense several minutes in which ground controllers were unsure about the health of the spacecraft, designed and operated by Houston-based Intuitive Machines, company officials declared it had landed successfully and was communicating with Earth. About 2 hours after the landing, the company confirmed that after troubleshooting communications, the spacecraft was indeed standing upright, a momentous feat for the growing commercial space industry. What we can confirm without a doubt is our equipment is on the surface of the moon, Tim Crane, Intuitive Machines' chief technology officer, said shortly after the landing, and we are transmitting, so congratulations. But initially, success was not assured. As the crews waited to hear from the spacecraft in the first few tense moments after the landing, Crane told his team that we're not dead yet, while wondering aloud if the spacecraft had landed at an off angle. Steve Altemus, the company's CEO, told his team, I know this was a nail-biter, but we are on the surface and we are transmitting. Welcome to the moon. The spacecraft touched down at 6:23 p.m. Eastern, near the moon's south pole, after a week-long journey that appeared to go very well from the moment it launched atop a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from the Kennedy Space Center. But as it prepared to descend to the surface, ground controllers realized that lasers intended to determine its altitude and horizontal velocity, key data points for it autonomously to land softly on the surface of the moon, weren't working. They ordered the craft to take an additional orbit around the moon before the landing attempt while uploading a software patch that would allow the spacecraft to begin using a NASA Doppler LiDAR system that was to have been a technology demonstration during the flight. We weren't planning to use it in line with the actual mission coming down to the landing, but now we are, said the Deputy Associate Administrator for NASA's Space Technology Mission Directorate. So basically, it is now the primary system to help provide the velocity and altitude information so that the lander can land safely on the surface. The apparent landing of the company's 14-foot-tall Nova C lander, which had no people on board, is the first time a commercial spacecraft has reached the lunar surface, and it validates a big bet that NASA placed several years ago when it started a $2.9 billion program to hire a fleet of robotic private sector spacecraft to carry science experiments, technology instruments, and eventually cargo to the moon. The Intuitive Machines mission was carried out as part of that program, known as the Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program, or CLPS. NASA awarded Intuitive Machines a $118 million contract to carry 6 instruments to the lunar surface that would help pave the way for future missions under its Artemis program, which seeks to return astronauts to the moon as early as 2026. Last month, another commercial company, Astrobiotic of Pittsburgh, failed in its attempt to reach the lunar surface after its spacecraft suffered a propulsion problem. When it first announced its commercial lunar payload services program several years ago, NASA's leaders acknowledged the risk it was taking in relying so heavily on the private sector, which had never before sent a vehicle to the moon. But NASA has continued to insist that even if some of the missions failed, there would be others that succeeded, and that the often risk-averse agency would be happy to continue to take shots on goal, as they said. This is really a significant shift in how we do business, Lori Glaze, the director of NASA's Planetary Science Division, said in an interview before the landing. The fact that NASA is not actually building or responsible directly for these missions or their launches is an opportunity to invest in the commercial industry to build a new capability. NASA can then purchase the delivery service, and the intent hopefully being that we can increase the frequency of deliveries and reduce the cost to NASA of doing science. The landing is a coup for NASA at a time when several nations are eyeing the moon, particularly the lunar South Pole, where there is water in the form of ice. Water is not only vital to sustaining human life, but the hydrogen and oxygen could also be used as rocket fuel. The moon's South Pole scientifically has been intriguing for a long time, in part because the rocks are really old, Glaze said. We believe they're at least 3.85 billion years old, which kind of goes back to the very early days of the moon. Getting information about those rocks, eventually we'll be able to tell more about the history of the moon. And then, by knowing that history, it tells us more about the history of Earth. China has said it intends to land astronauts on the moon by 2030 and eventually build a research station there. Last month, Japan became the 5th country to land on the moon when its robotic spacecraft touched down, though on its side. In 2023, India landed a spacecraft on the moon as well. Under its Artemis program, NASA intends to establish an enduring presence at the lunar South Pole. Created under the Trump administration, the program was cast as part of a space race with China, and in 2019, then-Vice President Pence directed NASA to return astronauts to the moon by this year. That won't happen. But the program was embraced by the Biden administration, the first time a deep space human exploration campaign has survived subsequent presidential administrations since the Apollo era. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, a Biden appointee, has also said the United States is in a race with China. But recently, NASA said the next missions in the Artemis program would be pushed back even further because of an array of technical difficulties. NASA successfully flew its Orion crew capsule without anyone on board around the moon in late 2022. But its next flight, known as Artemis II, won't happen until September 2025 at the earliest, NASA has said. In that flight, Orion will carry 4 astronauts, 3 Americans and 1 Canadian, around the moon. Artemis III, the first human landing attempt since Apollo, will be pushed back to late 2026, NASA said. NASA, however, has grown concerned about the effectiveness of Orion's heat shield, which protects the astronauts from the super high temperature generated as the spacecraft re-enters Earth's atmosphere after engineers detected more charring than expected from the initial flight. There have also been delays in the development of the space suits the astronauts will wear on the moon, and of the Starship spacecraft being built by SpaceX that NASA has picked to ferry astronauts to and from the lunar surface on the first flight. Obtaining images of lunar dust during landing, among the goals. Odysseus is carrying a number of commercial and NASA payloads, including instruments designed by the space agency to capture images of the dust plume kicked up by the spacecraft's engines. Since NASA anticipates eventually landing multiple spacecraft close to one another, It wants to better understand what effects landings have on the moon's surface and environment. It's going to cause the dust to really churn up and create a big plume of dust, said Susan Lederer, NASA's project scientist for the Intuitive Machines mission. And so it's going to be taking a set of cameras and looking down as that plume of dust comes up. That, she said, will help future landers to be developed to better protect against the dust that's being churned up. The spacecraft is also carrying a camera system designed by students and faculty from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University that will be ejected from the spacecraft at about 100 feet above the moon's surface to take images of the vehicle during the landing sequence. Another NASA experiment would use radio waves and antennae in the spacecraft's fuel tank to measure how much is available. For deep space missions, NASA is likely to use liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, or liquid methane that have to be kept at super cold temperatures. These propellants are highly efficient but are tricky to store as they can evaporate quickly, even at low temperatures, according to NASA. Being able to accurately measure spacecraft fuel levels will help scientists maximize resources as NASA moves toward its goal of returning humans to the moon through Artemis. As noted in this Washington Post article, the Odysseus's landing was not entirely smooth. For more information on the several problems encountered, we turn to a transcript of NPR's broadcast of an Associated Press article on February 23rd at 9:36 p.m. Eastern Time. U.S. lunar lander is on its side, with some antennas covered up, the company says. Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. A private U.S. lunar lander tipped over at touchdown and ended up on its side near the moon's south pole, hampering communications, company officials said last Friday. Intuitive Machines initially believed its six-footed lander, Odysseus, was upright after Thursday's touchdown. But CEO Steve Altemus said Friday the craft, quote, caught a foot in the surface, unquote, falling on its side and quite possibly leaning against a rock. He said it was coming in too fast and may have snapped a leg. So far, we have quite a bit of operational capability, even though we're tipped over, he told reporters. But some antennas were pointed toward the surface, limiting flight controllers' ability to get data down. The antennas were stationed high on the 14-foot lander to facilitate communications at the hilly, cratered, and shadowed south polar region. Odysseus, the first U.S. lander in more than 50 years, is thought to be within a few miles of its intended landing site near the Malapert A crater, less than 200 miles from the South Pole. NASA, the main customer, wanted to get as close as possible to the pole to scout out the area before astronauts show up later this decade. NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter will attempt to pinpoint the lander's location as it flies overhead this weekend. With Thursday's touchdown, Intuitive Machines became the first private business to pull off a moon landing, a feat previously achieved by only five countries. Japan was the latest country to score a landing, but its lander also ended up on its side last month. Odysseus's mission was sponsored in large part by NASA, whose experiments were on board. NASA paid $118 million for the delivery under a program meant to jumpstart the lunar economy. One of the NASA experiments was pressed into service when the lander's navigation system did not kick in. Intuitive Machines caught the problem in advance when it tried to use its lasers to improve the lander's orbit. Otherwise, flight controllers would not have discovered the failure until it was too late, just 5 minutes before touchdown. Serendipity is absolutely the right word, mission director Tim Crane said. It turns out that a switch was not flipped before flight, preventing the system's activation in space. Launched last week from Florida, Odysseus took an extra lap around the moon Thursday to allow time for the last-minute switch to NASA's laser system, which saved the day, officials noted. Another experiment, a cube with four cameras, was supposed to pop off 30 seconds before touchdown to capture pictures of Odysseus's landing. But Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Eagle Cam was deliberately powered off during the final descent because of the navigation switch, and stayed attached to the lander. Embry-Riddle's Troy Henderson said his team will try to release Eagle Cam in the coming days so it can photograph the lander from roughly 26 feet away. Getting that final picture of the lander on the surface is still an incredibly important task for us, Henderson told the Associated Press. Intuitive Machines anticipates just another week of operations on the moon for the solar-powered lander, 9 or 10 days at most, before lunar nightfall hits. The company was the second business to aim for the moon under NASA's Commercial Lunar Services Program. Last month, Pittsburgh's Astrobiotic Technology gave it a shot, but a fuel leak on the lander cut the mission short, and the craft ended up crashing back to Earth. Until Thursday, the U.S. had not landed on the moon since Apollo 17's Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt closed out NASA's famed moon landing program in December 1972. NASA's new effort to return astronauts to the moon is named Artemis after Apollo's mythological twin sister. The first Artemis crew landing is planned for 2026 at the earliest. The second big science news this week comes from National Public Radio, NPR. Paleontologists discover a 240-million-year-old dragon fossil in full. By Deba Mottasham, posted on February 23, 2024. It's a fitting discovery in the Year of the Dragon. A team of scientists has uncovered a complete fossil of an aquatic reptile that resembles a Chinese dragon because of its snake-like appearance and elongated neck. The fossil of the Dinocephalosaurus orientalis dates back 240 million years to the Triassic period and was found in the Guizhou province of southern China. While the reptile was first identified in 2003, this latest discovery is more complete, about 16 feet long, and allowed the scientists to depict the strange prehistoric creature in full for the first time. It is yet one more example of the weird and wonderful world of the Triassic that continues to baffle paleontologists, said Nick Fraser, head of the National Museum of Scotland's Department of Natural Sciences, in a news release released Friday. We are certain that it will capture imaginations across the globe due to its striking appearance, reminiscent of the long and snake-like mythical Chinese dragon. Professor Li Chun from the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology said the find has been an international effort. The researchers behind the discovery are from Scotland, Germany, America, and China. The team studied the bizarre reptile at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology in Beijing. Its flippered limbs and exquisitely preserved fish in its stomach indicate the reptile was adapted to the ocean, the researchers said. We used newly discovered specimens housed at the Chinese Academy of Sciences to build on our existing knowledge of this animal, said Chun. Among all of the extraordinary finds we have made in the Triassic of Guizhou province, Dinocephalosaurus probably stands out as the most remarkable. Stefan Spiekman, a postdoctoral researcher based at the Stuttgart State Museum of Natural History, added that the team hopes future research will help unveil more about the evolution of this group of animals, in particular how the extraordinarily long neck functioned. The neck has 32 separate vertebrae, longer than the creature's body and tail combined, and presumably played a key role in feeding, according to a study published by the Cambridge University Press. Birdwatching on a massive scale is also in the news. From the New York Times, dated March 11, 2024, with an orange-tufted spider hunter, birder breaks record for sightings. On February 9th, Peter Kastner stood in the shadow of what is referred to as the Niagara Falls of the Philippines, on the Philippine island of Mindanao, on the cusp of a record he'd spent 7 decades chasing and worried that he'd arrived too late. For years, nobody alive had seen and identified more bird species than Mr. Kastner. A retired American diplomat, he is birding's ultimate big lister, a star of the small but growing subculture of hyper-competitive bird watchers who scour the globe vying to see as many species as possible. An obsessive birder since childhood, Mr. Kastner woke up that morning in February with 9,997 birds on his personal life list, more than 90% of Earth's scientifically recognized species, and three away from a singular milestone. But he felt hurried. A few weeks earlier, in an essay for the American Birding Association, he had outlined his plans to become the first person to document 10,000 sightings. Shortly after, new information forced him to expedite his plans. "I realized when I was writing it that I was putting a target on my back," Mr. Kastner said, from his home in Cockeysville, Maryland. He didn't waste time. Mr. Kastner spent a chunk of January in Taiwan, racking up 15 new bird sightings. Soon he was in the Philippines, squeezing in an extra trip to the archipelago before another he had planned for March. Working with a local guide, Mr. Kastner needed to see 19 new birds in 7 days to reach 10,000. By mid-afternoon on February 9th, he had reached 9,999 when they heard an unfamiliar call coming from a nearby heliconia thicket. When the bird appeared, Mr. Kastner had no doubt about what it was, an orange-tufted spider hunter, a banana-loving songbird with a sinisterly down-curved bill. Documenting the sighting with a photograph made Mr. Kastner the first birder to reach 10,000 species, a momentous achievement once considered unreachable. "The number of people that helped over the years was extraordinary," Mr. Kastner said. Depending on the taxonomic authority, scientists generally agree that there are roughly 11,000 bird species in the world. Fewer than 60 people have ever seen 8,000. Fewer than 20 have surpassed 9,000. Only 271 bird species have ever been recorded at Central Park, a world-renowned birding destination. Only around 750 are found in the U.S. and Canada. Competitive birding has no official scoreboard. While many birders use photographs and field notes to provide evidence, documentation is largely based on a self-reported honor system. For many years, the preferred platform for Mr. Kastner and other big listers was surfbirds.com, before the site grew glitchy and unreliable last year. Now they use modern digital platforms like eBird and iGoTerra. Further complicating matters, the number of accepted species is constantly changing, making lists like Mr. Kastner's more living organism than stone tablet. The mega listing world is small, though, so the big players often know their competition. Mr. Kastner had long considered Philip Rostron, a British birder, his biggest challenger, and Ross Gilardi his heir apparent. But very few people in that world were aware of Jason Mann, an avid but little-known American birder living overseas, who emerged as Mr. Kastner's chief competitor last year. By that point, Mr. Kastner had his sights set on 10,000, having already broken the world record set by Klaus Göran Sederlund, who died in 2020, but has been posthumously credited with 9,829 sightings. In January, Mr. Mann sent shockwaves through the listing world when he updated his total to 9,950 from 9,600, putting him just 50 birds shy of 10,000. His list immediately raised eyebrows. Included were several species either long presumed extinct or extraordinarily rare, like the New Caledonian nightjar, which had not been verifiably seen since 1939. 12 hours before Mr. Kastner found his spider hunter and announced his achievement online, Mr. Mann announced in a since-deleted news release that he had reached 10,000, prompting further and fervent online scrutiny. "Because the two claims came out on the same day, it sort of went viral," said Mr. Kastner. "How in the world could this happen? This thing that has never happened in the history of mankind, that two birders get 10,000 on the same day? It's crazy." The uproar deeply surprised Mr. Mann, who for 40 years had birded the world in anonymity, never identifying as a lister. He generally kept his records private, since spending time online undercut the foundation of his passions, being outside. In an interview, he said that his bird list was only a fraction of the 20,000 plus species of plants, mammals, and other fauna he had digitized, acknowledging minor errors in the upload process, but no malintent. Amid the backlash, Mr. Mann publicly recognized Kaestner as the record holder and again turned his list private. He said he hoped that any recent publicity helped to support bird conservation and encouraged young people to get outdoors. I love life, human and non-human, and birds are a great lens to experience that through, Mr. Mann said. Birding brings health and positivity, building my understanding for the interconnected web of life on which we all depend. It allows me to return to family and work recharged and with a broader perspective, like adding colors to the rainbow. Mr. Kaestner began birding in Baltimore, emulating his older brother Hank, who ranks 9th in the world according to eBird. Mr. Kaestner joined the Peace Corps in Zaire after graduating from Cornell University in 1976. A subsequent 36-year career in the Foreign Service shuffled him across the globe from underbirded places like Afghanistan and Egypt to birding meccas like India and Brazil. He has seen at least one bird in 190 countries and territories recognized by eBird, including Antarctica. In 1986, he became the first person to see a representative of every bird family. He discovered a new species, the Kundinamarca antpitta, in 1989. His quest led him to some of the planet's most inaccessible places to find birds. He has navigated guerrilla-held territory in politically unstable regions in Colombia, dodged the initial Ebola outbreak in Zaire, endured near-fatal altitude sickness in Peru, thwarted car thieves in remote villages, and survived flash floods. He has been lost mountain climbing in the Solomon Islands, shipwrecked in the Amazon, and been guided through deep Papua New Guinea jungle by locals wearing human skull necklaces. My life is almost Forrest Gumpian, Mr. Kaestner said. I've had amazing stories of near disaster, and things have sort of just worked out beautifully. I feel incredibly lucky. And this article, with an orange tufted spider hunter, birder breaks record for sightings, documenting his 10,000th bird species, was posted on March 11th, 2024, in the New York Times. Not every birder is hyper-competitive. Not every bird watcher will be able to see 10,000 species in a lifetime. But in Birding to Change the World, Trish O'Kane speaks to the wonder, the transformative power of bird watching. From Bookshelf in the February 24th, 2024 issue of Science News, a review of Trish O'Kane's book is written by Aaron Tremper. A spark bird is a species that inspires someone to start birdwatching. For Trish O'Kane, that bird was the northern cardinal. The backyard regular caught her eye while she was living with a friend in New Orleans, 5 months after Hurricane Katrina ravaged the region and her house in August 2005. Hearing cardinals' chipping calls was an initial step toward over 1,960 hours of birding, 33 field notebooks filled with avian antics, and a career change. In her memoir, Birding to Change the World, O'Kane charts her pivot from human rights journalist to environmentalist. She worked as a hate crime researcher, an investigative reporter, and a writing instructor for incarcerated mothers before starting work as a journalism instructor at Loyola University, New Orleans, the week before Hurricane Katrina hit. How to stop war, how to end economic injustice, how to fight racism and white supremacy, these global problems were the focus of my life and work, she writes. I never paid any attention to environmental issues. Her fledgling interest in birds actually began a few days before the monster storm arrived. O'Kane notes how, despite the gorgeous weather, flocks of alarmed gulls shrieked over one of the levees near Lake Pontchartrain. This was the first time I began to think of them as more than pretty flying objects, and instead as creatures with their own agendas, she writes. But they can't watch CNN, so how could they possibly know that a massive hurricane is going to hit us in less than 48 hours? It's one of many moments where O'Kane makes sense of the bizarre abilities of birds, bizarre by human standards, anyway, by weaving established research with interviews with scientists. The gulls were reacting to sharp drops in barometric pressure from the encroaching storm. Post-Katrina, O'Kane must navigate between working at Loyola and coping with the loss of her home. She finds relief in watching the birds that flit about in New Orleans' Audubon Park. She starts bringing her class along for writing sessions. House sparrows, often scorned by bird enthusiasts for killing native birds, transform into a symbol of resourcefulness by building nests and foraging among the wreckage. My students stare at me in disbelief when I tell them that until I was 45 years old, I never cared about birds, O'Kane writes. She strived to make the world a better place for people. Now she was considering the welfare of wildlife. I suddenly wondered how many creatures had died simply because of the way I lived. She decides to pursue an eco-oriented career. In 2007, she enrolls in a doctorate program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison to study environmental science. Most of the book focuses on O'Kane's efforts to preserve Warner Park along Madison's Lake Mendota. It's a convenient location for O'Kane to satisfy birding requirements for an ornithology class. But soon she successfully campaigns to stop the construction of a parking lot in one of the park's meadows. Her activism snowballs into Wild Warner, a local crew of wildlife watchers flocking together to defend the park from further development. The organization eventually becomes part of O'Kane's dissertation research, along with a birding class that pairs middle school students with college student mentors. It's here that the memoir shows readers that an expertise in nature doesn't require a degree. Take Jan, a retired feed mill worker, plagued by chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. O'Kane calls Jan an ecology goldmine of animal stories thanks to his walks through Warner Park prescribed by his doctor. Then there's Jeremy, a seemingly disinterested boy enrolled in O'Kane's birding class. When reporters join an outing, the normally quiet Jeremy gushes about indigo buntings. O'Kane soon learns that Jeremy had taken to secretly studying the field guide gifted to him by his mentor. O'Kane's love for common birds fuels much of her work, a refreshing reminder of the incredible feats of nature happening in our own neighborhoods. A birder chasing the next exotic species to cross off their bird life list might dismiss the sighting of a shy gray catbird, readily found meowing under the cover of a nearby hedge. O'Kane, though, studies catbird migration. By strapping the birds with radar backpacks, her team confirms that the Warner Park's catbirds migrate every fall as far as Mexico and Guatemala before returning each spring. At its core, the book Birding to Change the World is about how people and birds today depend on one another. For birds, that dependence is tangible. For instance, the preservation of marsh habitat for wetland species. For people, the connection can be less concrete. For millennia, our species has seen birds as symbols of liberation, O'Kane writes. In her case, it was liberation from the grief and depression that Katrina brought. Bird by bird, every chickadee, nuthatch, catbird, wren, and owl forged a new neural pathway in my brain, a joyful pathway. This review of Trish O'Kane's Birding to Change the World appears in the February 24th, 2024 issue of Science News. All eyes are on the sun. The great eclipse. The upcoming eclipse and a pair of new spacecraft flying near the sun will revolutionize solar physics, appears in the March 2024 issue of Scientific American. On April 8, 2024, a 115-mile-wide strip of North America will be plunged into darkness. The disk of the moon will slip in front of the sun, obscuring its face and creating a rosy, fluffy crown of flame, visible from Mazatlan, Mexico to Newfoundland, Canada. It will be the last spectacle of its kind for a generation. The next total solar eclipse viewable from across North America will be on August 23, 2044. Spectators aren't the only ones excited. A solar eclipse is one of the best ways for scientists to study the solar corona, that ring of fire that stands out when the moon blocks our bright star. This feature remains one of the most mysterious parts of the sun. Astronomers originally thought the corona was a feature of the moon, perhaps sunlight reflecting off the lunar atmosphere. But the moon has no atmosphere. It was not until 1806 that Spanish astronomer José Joaquín de Ferrer recognized it was a feature of the sun instead, giving it the name corona, the Spanish word for crown. We now know that the corona is the sun's shockingly hot outer atmosphere. This atmosphere releases a mysterious wind of particles and occasionally unleashes clumps of itself in roiling packages of energy called coronal mass ejections. What we don't know, however, is how or why those things happen. On April 8th, astronomers will train their telescopes on the corona in hopes of demystifying these phenomena. They'll be aided by two new spacecraft that have recently arrived at the sun, gathering data from near and even within the corona. These probes, plus the insights scientists expect to gain from the eclipse, should make this year the most exciting time in solar physics since the dawn of the field. Solar physics was born during a total solar eclipse in August 1868. Astronomers had just begun using prisms to investigate spectroscopy, splitting the sun's light into its component colors, and studying the star's chemical makeup. The sun's spectrum contains barcode-like dark lines indicating the presence of elements, such as hydrogen, sodium, and iron, among others. Two astronomers independently captured the sun's spectrum during the August 1868 eclipse and found that it contained a new line corresponding to a new element, the first element discovered off Earth. They named it helium, after the Greek god Helios, who represented the sun. The following year, during another total solar eclipse, astronomers in Iowa saw something else odd in the sun's spectrum, a bright green line in the corona that they suspected belonged to a new chemical element. They announced the discovery of coronium, found only in the sun's halo of glorious purple-pink flames. It would be 70 years before another physicist correctly identified coronium as a strange form of iron that had been ionized 13 times, meaning it had half the electrons of a typical iron atom. This state was possible only if the iron atoms had been cooked in a terrific crucible of around 2 million degrees Fahrenheit. The surface of the sun, however, is 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That meant the corona was 200 times hotter than the surface, where the heat and light are emitted. It would be like sitting in front of a campfire in a seat 200 times hotter than the burning wood. Scientists have struggled to explain this immense temperature difference ever since. That's where modern solar physics really starts, says Dan Seaton, a solar physicist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. Nobody had ever thought that the sun would have had million degree or hotter plasma in it. What does it mean? What are the consequences of it? The biggest consequence of this discovery followed a trivial calculation, in the words of Eugene Parker, an astrophysicist at the University of Chicago. In 1958, Parker found that if the corona is 2 million degrees, the laws of fluid dynamics suggest that it must generate a constant outflow of particles that would eventually travel faster than the speed of sound. Parker's idea was met with resistance, but in 1962, the Mariner 2 spacecraft confirmed that the particles, called the solar wind, do in fact exist. Scientists still don't fully understand why. They are beginning to get answers, though, thanks to two spacecraft, including one named after Parker. The Parker Solar Probe, which was mentioned in the last article from Science News, was launched by NASA in 2018 and is one of the toughest spacecraft ever constructed. Its 4.5-inch thick carbon composite sun shield can handle temperatures of nearly 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit and 2.8 million watts of solar energy. Its articulated solar panels can retract behind it for protection, and its onboard water-based cooling system absorbs heat from the solar panels and then radiates it into space. The probe was designed to dip closer to the sun than anything else humans have ever built, sampling its atmosphere, wind, magnetic fields, and light. In 2021, the Parker Solar Probe became the first spacecraft to fly through the sun's corona, and since then, it has made nearly 20 close approaches. During its 7-year mission, it will complete 24 orbits around our star, using the gravitational field of Venus to slingshot itself ever closer to the sun. Its 7th and final Venus flyby is set for November 2024. Sending the Parker Solar Probe to skim the surface of the sun, diving into the million-degree corona, is a wild, absurdly risky, and almost unbelievable thing to try, Seaton says. It's mind-blowing that the thing works. The second craft scientists are counting on is the Solar Orbiter, a European Space Agency probe launched in 2020, also mentioned in the last article. It is currently observing the sun from within the orbit of Mercury, not as close as the Parker probe, but close enough to study the heliosphere, a bubble of charged particles that the sun blows in all directions and whose edges constitute the end of our solar system. It is the first observatory to make a detailed study of the sun's uncharted polar regions, which are difficult or impossible to see from Earth. The two spacecraft are the latest in a series of about 24 sun-observing spacecraft launched since 1961's Explorer 10. Of those, 19 are still alive, in addition to many solar observatories on Earth. The Parker Solar Probe and the Solar Orbiter will soon be accompanied by other solar-observing spacecraft and sounding rockets, which will observe the sun from Earth's atmosphere. In April 2025, NASA plans to launch the Polarimeter to unify the corona and heliosphere, or PUNCH, PUNCH for short, which will make three-dimensional observations of the nascent solar wind as it grows and spreads throughout the solar system. Future spacecraft might revisit the sun at higher latitudes, a major challenge for spaceflight engineers, but one that would thrill heliophysicists. Solar physics really is a very young science, says Lisa Upton, a solar physicist at Space Systems Research Corporation in Boulder, Colorado. Most of what we know about the sun we have only learned since the dawn of the space age. Space exploration allows scientists, or at least their robotic proxies, to visit the sun up close. The Parker Solar Probe draws so near to the star that researchers have occasionally worried about the spacecraft's health. But so far, the probe has weathered whatever the sun has thrown its way. One particularly violent outburst occurred on March 12, 2023, about a year ago, when the Parker Solar Probe was pointing directly at the sun. Sailing just 5.3 million miles from the sun's surface, around a sixth of the distance the scorched planet Mercury reaches in its orbit, the spacecraft's heat shield baked. Sensitive instruments tucked behind it were carefully sampling the sun's outer atmosphere. Then the sun unleashed an unusually fast, abnormally powerful burst of charged plasma. The Parker probe was positioned to fly right through it. The sun, Earth, the Parker Solar Probe, and the Solar Orbiter were all aligned for the coronal mass ejection, or CME. More than 40 observatories on Earth were watching at the same time, building an unprecedented view of the event, which rocked the spacecraft like waves tossing a boat. We were so close to the sun and it was so intense. We were able to see that in the accelerometer data that showed the movement and vibrations of the probe, says Jim Kinnison, mission system engineer for Parker Solar Probe at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, APL. I don't think anybody has ever seen that before. The CME, or coronal mass ejection, triggered space weather warnings on Earth because these emissions of charged particles can energize our planet's upper atmosphere, interfering with satellites and radio communications. The Parker probe saw the entire thing, from the CME's generation to its emission from the sun's surface, or photosphere, to its propagation in the space between our star and our planet. We thought we kind of understood the structure of these CMEs, but what the Parker Solar Probe showed us with the level of detail we are getting, it is way, way more complex than we thought, says Noor Rauafi, Parker Solar Probe project scientist at APL. We came to the conclusion that all the models we have for these events cannot explain everything we are seeing. Just like Earth, the sun contains layers. Deep inside is the core, where the sun fuses hydrogen into helium and other heavier elements. Surrounding this orb is the radiative zone, then a convection zone, which generates magnetic fields. The outermost layers are the photosphere, the bright surface, the chromosphere, the transition region, and the corona. These are all dominated by different types of physics, from fluid dynamics and heat flows to magnetic fields and particle acceleration. This complexity makes it very difficult to study the sun as a whole, says Charles Kankelborg, a physicist at Montana State University. Every now and then, he says, I wake up in the morning and think, wouldn't it be nice to be an astrophysicist? Because I wouldn't have all this to work with. The new data pouring in mean scientists can finally build a fuller picture of how the sun works. I've been doing this for more than 20 years, and suddenly it feels like everything is interesting and exciting, and it's all happening at once, Seton says. It's really exciting to come to the office every day, and it wasn't like that before. Scientists think the solar wind originates in the corona, but they're not entirely sure exactly where or how. What's more, the solar wind consists of two types of wind. First, the so-called fast solar wind, which can travel at 1.7 million miles per hour and fills the heliosphere, and the slow wind, which streams from equatorial areas at 700,000 miles per hour. In heliophysics, words like fast and slow are relative. The fast and slow winds contain different elements and different numbers of electrons, suggesting they form in different ways. Both are related to magnetic fields. Those magnetic fields are complex because the sun is a plasma of charged particles. As it burns hydrogen into helium in its core, energy flows to its surface, moving heat through convection. Because the sun rotates at different speeds at its equator and its poles, as magnetic fields arise from iron in its core, as they twist and curl amid these solar paroxysms. Unlike a magnet with a fixed polarity, the sun's magnetic fields are like grains of rice swirling in a pot of boiling water. The magnetic fields get tangled and twisted and wrapped up into these really complex configurations that aren't intuitive, Upton says. Magnetic fields with opposite polarities can cancel each other out and make a U-turn, shooting off in a new direction. When this reconnection happens, the new magnetic field lines generate enormous force, like a taut rubber band being snapped. And this force flings plasma out from the sun. Recent research based on NASA and ESA data found that crossed magnetic field lines sometimes cause certain types of kinks, unleashing S-shaped waves that hurl plasma around. These switchbacks are thought to help generate the slow solar wind. Shortly thereafter, scientists on the Parker team determined how magnetic reconnection may also cause the fast solar wind. Rauafi and his colleagues showed that its flow originates at the base of the corona, from small-scale jets of plasma called jetlets. Later in 2023, solar physicists also found streams of particles that originate in holes in the corona, giving rise to the fast wind. The differences between the slow and fast solar winds may be found in how the magnetic fields are arranged within coronal holes. If the solar wind is a torrential shower, the jetlets are like the individual droplets that make up the overall stream. The jetlets are found in bright spots where magnetic field lines dive into and spring out from the sun. Taken together, the magnetic reconnection process, coronal holes, and jetlets allow the solar wind to rise through the corona and escape the sun's gravity to form the fast solar wind. These things that we didn't understand about the sun, the extra heating, the way the wind gets up to these high speeds, these weird magnetic switchbacks, these are actually very intimately connected, says Justin Casper, a solar physicist at the University of Michigan. There's kind of a universal picture now that is starting to take shape. The sun does not generate its corona through one simple process. Small, again a relative term, dynamic phenomena are driving larger scale, obvious phenomena at the sun that we can observe readily but don't understand well, says Craig DeForest, a solar physicist at the Southwest Research Institute. I think what we're finding is that they are all interrelated, he says. People have speculated, but the jetlet discovery was the smoking gun showing that these small, explosive events are important to the corona and solar wind. Other experts disagree about the jetlets having enough energy to accelerate the solar wind, however. The spurting jetlets might constitute a large part of the fast solar wind, but they might not be what gives rise to it, says Judy Carpin, an astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. But the role of reconnection in all of these seems to be very much the common feature, she says. The jetlets do seem to have enough energy to keep the solar wind fed, if not to create it, Kankelberg says. The jetlets may also contribute to the corona's extreme heat, another long-standing mystery. Scientists suspect that the sun and its magnetic reconnection superheats the coronal plasma, and small-scale phenomena such as the jetlets or related phenomena called nanoflares might play a role. The sun is a particle accelerator, a ball of plasma, a self-sustaining thermonuclear reactor, a gale of mass and energy, the source of all life. That we can get close to it, that we're coming closer to understanding it, is a wondrous thing. Studying the sun and its activity connects many disciplines of science, but it also connects us to the other planets. By knowing our mother star, we also come to know about its sister stars throughout the cosmos that are too far away for us to inspect in detail. These studies will even help us understand the planets around those other stars, and they in turn might shed light on our sun as well, says C. Alex Young, a heliophysicist at the Goddard Space Flight Center. For instance, scientists hope that their studies of exoplanet systems will help them understand what our sun was like when it was newly born, and what it will be like near its death some 5 billion years from now. Ultimately, if we can learn the sun's nature, we will come to know ourselves better and understand the physical reasons for an inescapable core fact of our existence, that the sun rises every morning and always will. And this article, The Great Eclipse, was written by Rebecca Boyle. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.